almost Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm having a chat with Matt Beaumont, who wrote the book E. And if you were in and around advertising around the turn of the century, God, that sounds really old. If you were in advertising around 1999, that sounds a bit newer, doesn't it? It sounds a bit more jazzy and futuristic, even though it's 15 years ago. So, if you were in advertising around then, you can't have failed to have noticed the impact E had on advertising. I mean, aside from anything else, Campaign loved it so much they gave Matt and his partner a column to write in Campaign Diary every week. But, you know, besides that, it's a book about advertising written in email. So to be able to write that, Matt had to work in advertising for a while. So what we have gone into is his early career, including a trip to Hong Kong to be a creative director there, despite being quite young. And then the advertising Matt has done afterwards as well. I mean, he took about 7 years to continue writing other novels and then came back into it to set up a sort of agency within an agency at M&C Saatchi. So here's our chat, and I hope you enjoy it. Well, thanks a lot for joining me here. I don't know. I'm in LA. You're in London, I'm assuming. Matt, is that right?
I'm in London, yeah, in the heart of Soho. In the heart Piccadilly Tube Station, actually. So not in the heart, the bottom corner of Soho.
The lungs, the liver, maybe.
Yeah. The spleen of Soho.
Spleen of Soho. That should be a pub, the spleen of Soho. Yeah, anyway, so fantastic for you to make the time. Very grateful for that. I think it's probably, although we'll get onto your book, brackets books later on, I think if we start off with the advertising thing, because obviously your book came from the world of advertising, but I'd like to know, just as a beginning thing, how and why you bothered or were interested in getting into the industry in the first place.
Remember quite vividly why I got into it. I was doing a graphic design course at Central School of Art in London, and there was no advertising content on that course. It was actually a very left-wing course in terms of the people who were running it were quite left-wing, quite contemptuous of advertising and what it did. But I was working as a hamburger chef part-time, to subsidise my, student living. And there was a waitress at that restaurant where I was working with an art buyer at an agency called KMP. And she said, why don't you come into KMP for your Easter holidays and work there? And I remember meeting an art director there called Ken Hoggins, who's possibly still around in the business, is a great guy, and doing like a three-week work experience in there and thinking, I've got a real taste for it. It's really exciting. And I saw people who seemed to have a really good time and what seemed to me at the time lots of money, doing interesting, exciting things, having a laugh, and I thought, I really want to do this. So I spent the last year of my graphic design course not following the curriculum at all that they gave me and doing advertising briefs. And my degree show was an advertising show, which kind of went against the grain of the course, but they let me do it and gave me a degree in the end. And that's how I got into it. So it wasn't through education. It was a happy accident of meeting someone, in a part-time job in a restaurant. So that was me into advertising. It was a complete accident, really.
Yeah, so if it was such an accident, because if you do courses like St. Martin's and Watford, they'll tell you that you're supposed to get a partner and a book and all that sort of stuff together. How did you find out about having to do those sorts of things, and did you find a partner?
Well, I found out, because they were very, I think Watford was just beginning at the time. We're talking about the very beginning of the 1980s here, so quite a long time ago. And in the UK, at least, there were very few dedicated advertising courses, very few general graphic design courses that had an advertising element to them. I think Watford was maybe just about going. What I did in my final year was this thing called the DNAD workshop, which was a weekly thing. You got set a brief by an agency, you did the brief, a week later you took your work in and stuck it up on the wall with a bunch of other students, and a professional art director, copywriter, creative team, whatever, would crit your work. And that was a really, really good way of seeing how, you know, learning the rules, basically, how to do advertising, seeing, you know, where you stood in the sort of pecking order of other kids who were trying to do the same thing as you, and getting useful and sometimes horrible feedback from professionals. So, you know, and that's how I got my book together, was, you know, was my degree show was basically brief. It consisted of work that I'd done to brief given through the DNAD workshop. I didn't do any college work in that last year. That's what I did. And I teamed up with a girl who was on my course who basically did the same as me. We teamed up. We had to decide which one of us was going to be the writer because I had an English A level. I said, well, I'll be the writer then. It was as simple as that. She was the art director. And, you know, we got a job as a team. And back then, it seemed like a relatively easy thing. We left college, you know, in June, July. And by the end of August, we had a job, like a proper job. Well, not some stupid work experience thing that kids seem to have to do now. They do endless, endless work placements before someone finally gives them a job. We got offered two jobs in one day at two very good agencies. We took one at an agency called WCRS. You know, it seemed really easy at the time to get a job in advertising. I don't think it's so easy now. I feel sorry for young people coming into the business who seem to struggle for a long time before someone employs them.
Yeah, it is a bit of a weird thing that where it's a very formally recognised system that you're going to have to eat pot noodles and live in a bedsit for several months or maybe even years while you... Well, people in advertising make their mind up about whether your £100 a week work was good enough for them and then take them on. So
And is that a universal thing? Is that how it works around the world? I don't really know. I don't know that how it works in the UK, you know, in the London scene. But, you know, you're speaking to me from the States. Is that how it works in the States?
Well, I can't speak for all the other agencies, but I know that at Media Arts Lab, where I'm working... we have a more formal system where we take people on a longer term basis on what we call a beta scheme, but it's similar to placement, but it's not as open ended, and like saying your time might end tomorrow if we decide it. It's more that we're going to have you for this amount of time with a view to building you up through the agency, as opposed to just going, hey, we'll give you a few months and see how it goes. It's a bit more solid than that.
It's a cruel system here, I think. I mean, maybe some places are getting a bit more humane about it, and HR departments are getting more involved in thinking we can't pay people nothing to come and do real life briefs and maybe actually contribute to what this agency is doing and then to the bottom line and pay them nothing. I don't think they can get away with it anymore, so it's possibly not as bad as it was. But it's still a health slog, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd imagine that the industry was different in a lot of ways in the early 80s, and WCRS must have been very different because it must have just been starting off at that point. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there were, you know, I was employee number 41 and my partner was employee number 42, so it was relatively small at the time. It's only been going about a year or 18 months maybe when we joined. We were the first junior team. I mean, they started on the promise that they would have no junior people working for them. They would not, you know, inflict, you know, relatively untrained, callow people on their clients. So, but after a while, they realised that, well, possibly they had to. They couldn't just hire senior people. It was A, too expensive. B, you know, you just ended up with a bunch of really big egos and just arguing with each other all the time. So they needed some junior people like me and my partner who they could push around a little bit. They would do what they were told.
Well, I guess also with the people in charge there, with White, Collins and Rutherford, that must have been quite an interesting educational experience for a young creative.
It was very interesting. They were three very, very different people, you know, three creative people, you know, and one managing partner in Peter Scott. But, you know, three of the partners were creative. They were very, very different types of creative, often found it hard to work with each other and argued a lot. But, you know, we learned lots of very interesting and different things from each of them, I think, that, you know, lessons I carry with me to this day that still apply now, even in this changed world, this changed media landscape. I think the things I learned then pretty much apply now.
And did you stay at WCRS for a long time?
I was there for 3 years, and so yeah, relatively long time. And then I left and joined an agency called Lindhurst, which doesn't exist anymore. I was there for about another 3 years, and then I went to Hong Kong, believe it or not. I became creative director at Saatchi in Hong Kong, which I couldn't quite believe, because I've never done any kind of management job before. I'd never had a single creative team under me that I was in charge of. And suddenly I had an entire department, most of them Chinese, in a dual language culture. You know, it was horrific learning experience. it was very tough over there, and I went into it very naively thinking, oh, it'll be easy, but it wasn't.
So hang on, 6 years into your advertising career. Six years into your advertising career, you get asked to be CD of an agency halfway across the world. How did that come about?
There's a guy who's dead now called Andy Rourke, who was a sort of global creative director of Saatchi. He had some kind of international role. I think he looked after a lot of the offices that were outside of Europe, so in Asia, in Africa, you know, at that time, at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, Saatchi was on its sort of, you know, global domination quest, and was, you know, setting up offices everywhere, buying up companies everywhere, and I don't quite know how it happened. It came through a headhunter. He met me and my partner. I didn't go alone. I went with a guy called Alan Jarvie, my art director at the time, a guy I'd worked with for about 3 years at Lindhurst. And he hired us as a team, and we went over together. I didn't last so long. I left 18 months before the managing director fired me. He left us a bit longer, Alan, quite a bit longer than me, but I just fell out with the managing director and ended up coming home after 18 months. But it was a very interesting 18 months in so many ways. You know, a lot of it I didn't enjoy at the time, but I look back on it and thank God I did it, because it just changed me a lot and taught me a lot about how to deal with people and never to underestimate a situation that you're going into, because I did underestimate that situation. You know, not just taking on a management role, but taking on a management role in a country where the culture was so very different to what I was used to, you know, and where nearly everything we did had to work in two languages, Cantonese and English, which, God, that's difficult. You know, just doing headlines that translate, that work in both languages to support an idea, it was so, so hard. But anyway, interesting year.
Yeah, and was the standard of work sort of low? Because, I mean, I think now everyone's used to there being decent work in all sorts of pockets across the globe. But back in the 80s, even in the 90s, you know, most places outside of America and the UK weren't considered good places to work at all.
Yeah, you know, that's what I saw going over there. And one of the things I carried with me into Hong Kong was this kind of snobbery, London snobbery, that... you know, I came from a city where we created the best advertising in the world. No one else was quite as good, apart from maybe some places in New York or whatever. I came with a feeling that we were the best, and I was kind of disabused of that. But actually, there were some very talented people in Hong Kong doing some very good work, possibly less of it than there was in London. But, you know, the good work was arguably as good as it was anywhere. And there was an awful lot of dross, but if you're really honest and you look at an advertising market like the UK or the USA or anywhere else in Europe, most of what you see is dross. Absolutely terrible or ordinary or, you know, derivative, or you've seen it before, or it's, you know, badly executed. And the good work always stands out because of that. You know, and if you look at... you know, if you think a DNAD annual is the best, you know, is representative of British advertising, it's not really. It's representative of the cream of British advertising, but not representative of the mass of British advertising or design. And it's probably the same anywhere. So you sort of go, you know, that's one of the senses I was naive in as much as I thought, well, I'm bound to be better than everyone there, and I wasn't necessarily better than everyone there. There was very good people there who could do very good work in Chinese or English, you know, some very good art directors, you know. So that was interesting. You know, that was one of the lessons I learned, is never underestimate anything, never assume that because you come from somewhere, you're going to be better than everyone there.
Sure. So if you did a year and a half there, did you then just come back to London? And if so, what was it like having the year of
I came back to London in the pit of a recession and found it very hard to get work back here. So I freelanced here for a bit and eventually ended up at McCann Erickson sort of at some point in the 90s. I can't remember exactly which year. And that took me until about 1998. I was sort of a senior copywriter at McCann Erickson in London, which wasn't a great agency at the time, but I was glad to have a home and to have a wage, you know, because, I came back when it wasn't a good time to get work in London because no one was hiring. There was a horrible recession going on. And I struggled to find work for a bit.
Yeah, I guess if that was 98, that must have been the time when you were writing novels as well, then.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of this bookie that I wrote. It would not have happened were it not for McCann Erickson, I don't believe. Because, you know, I've got that, you know, even though it was in many ways a dreadful agency, at the time, it gave me a computer. I've never had a computer on my desk before, and by dint of that, it gave me email. And I remember resisting email for quite a while. Everyone else seemed to be talking to each other on email for quite a while before I did. I thought, now I'm going to phone people up and I'm going to go wander around the office and talk to people and do it the old-fashioned way. I'm not going to do this email thing. And finally I opened emails and realised that actually email was enormous fun. It was a really good way of talking to people, of having fun, of just finding stories of what was happening. And that's what inspired me to write emails, finding these stories of, you know, whether work related or not, you know, social things, work things, you know, stories would develop in these email threads. And it just struck me one day. I remember the moment when it struck me. I was driving in the car with my wife, Maria, and I said to her, I don't know where the thought came from, but it just seemed to drop out of the sky and in through the sunroof of the car. Could you tell a story in emails, entirely in emails, and not resort to anything else? Could you just tell a story in emails, this new thing that I was so excited by? And she said, that's a brilliant idea. You've got to do it. As soon as we get home, you're going to start writing that. And I did. I started writing it, this sort of comedy, just told in emails, and didn't really know what story I was going to tell, but I knew it was going to be about an advertising agency, set in an advertising agency that may or may not look a bit like McCann Erickson in London did at the time. That's where it all began. So again, it's kind of a happy accident, really. I wasn't planning to write a novel. I wasn't one of these copywriters who'd always thought, oh, I want to do some proper writing. I don't want to do advertising. I want to write a movie or a play or a novel. I've never really thought like that, but I just had this idea one day and wondered if it would make a novel, and it did. So there you go. It's as easy as that. You don't have to strive to be a novelist. It can just happen one day. It's about having an idea that's going to just be sustainable for 300 pages, and then you've got a novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether you wanted to do it before or you didn't, there's still a lot of craft and skill that goes into developing the novel. And I was trying to explain your novel to a friend at a party on Saturday night. I was going, I'm interviewing this guy, and he made this novel out of emails at the end of the 90s, start of the 2000s, and it was really fantastic. And it's really difficult until you read E to go, oh my God, everything just knits together brilliantly and the characters are really, really fantastic and all that sort of stuff. So it's not just that basic idea. Your skill as a novelist, you know, had to be, you know, at a decent level as well.
But you know what? It didn't seem difficult. And I don't know. It's funny because my second novel was a bastard to write. It was a real motherfucker to write that. The first one was easy, because I just went into it thinking, I didn't have to please anyone but myself and possibly Maria, my partner. You know, I was just making myself laugh and showing her what I'd written at the end of the day and making her laugh. And that's what it was about. It wasn't meant to go anywhere beyond that, because I wasn't thinking I'm going to get this published. I wasn't thinking publication for a long time into writing it. And also, I wasn't aware of what was involved in writing a novel, so I just kind of wrote it. I didn't plan it. I didn't plan any story. I didn't really think about the thing that restricting myself to email meant. It meant I couldn't write any sort of character description in the normal way or scene description. I couldn't paint a picture of what the office looked like or what people looked like, because I was just writing what people wrote to each other on email and leaving huge gaps for the reader to fill in. You know, they had to imagine what people looked like, imagine what kind of office it was, and so on. And, you know, there was no description of so-and-so had an Irish accent or whatever. So you had to think, well, does he sound a bit Irish just from the words on the email, if you see what I mean? None of the normal things that you can put into a novel in terms of descriptive prose were available for me. So I don't know if that made it easier for me or harder, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. I'm also wondering, because if it was in any way sort of based on your time at McCann's, were some of the characters close to real life characters, and did they realise, and were they offended? Did that happen?
Some of them were close to real characters, yes. Some of them were kind of amalgamations of types. Like one for instance, there's a character called Simon Hall, the creative director, who was, I don't know if I can say this word, you might want to edit it out, he's a real cunt.
We can have that word.
And he was, sorry?
We can have that word, that's fine.
Okay, he was a real cunt. and he, you know, he had all these pretensions and insecurities, and he was a bastard to his staff, and he stole ideas. He was the worst kind of creative director. He wasn't based on any one creative director I'd ever worked for or met or knew of. But he was, you know, he had some qualities that I'd seen in most of the creative directors I'd worked for to a certain extent. No one was as hideous as he was. But when the book came out and it sort of caught the imagination, certainly in London, in the London advertising scene, and lots of people were talking about it and speculating as to who this guy was. And, lots of names were put forward for who he might be based on. And some of whom, you know, mostly people I'd heard, because they were famous creative directors from, you know, the 1990s in London. But it wasn't any of them. Some of them I'd never met. Mm. You know, I knew them by reputation, possibly, but I didn't necessarily met them. I've certainly not worked with them. Lots of people who read the book saw qualities of people they knew in the character and speculated as to who those people might, you know, who the character might be based on. And a lot of it just wasn't true, even though in my mind some of the characters were kind of based on people I knew or types of people I knew. There's only one character in there who I could say honestly is based on one character, who was someone who was fairly senior at McCann Erickson at the time, and one character in the book is based on him. And I don't know if people want to work it out or you want to say his name.
maybe we'll leave that.
Yeah. Interestingly, the guy who it was based on assumed it was him, and he never came after me about it. And I think he was quite proud of it, even though he's not painted very nicely in the book. He's quite proud of the fact that it was based on him, I think. As far as I know, based on talking to him.
It's interesting that the speculation thing you're talking about, because for those of us either who weren't, you know, there'll be people listening to this who maybe came into advertising after E had its major sort of time, and also people who were there at the time but maybe don't remember exactly, how much it caught fire. Could you give us a few examples of, you know, the extent to which it became big, because it was just all over the industry for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it was published by HarperCollins in London, and it had a massive push behind it. They certainly compared to most debut novelists, you know, most debut novelists don't get any kind of marketing push behind their book. You know, everything, you know, is hopefully done on word of mouth, and probably the novelist, him or herself, does more publicity and marketing than the publishing house does, because they just don't have any money or time to do anything. My book, I was lucky, my book got a big push. You know, it got very prominently displayed in big booksellers like Waterstones and W.H. Smith and so on. And it was just everywhere for a few weeks. And it just really took off within the business. Campaign, the advertising journal in London, the UK, seized on it. They loved it. And every week there seemed to be someone in there talking about E. They got me to write a column, which I was doing with Maria. We wrote a sort of satirical advertising column for a year, which, you know, added to the noise around the book. It just did catch the imagination, certainly in London, and to a lesser extent in the sort of American advertising scene. It was published about 6 or 7 months later in the USA, and it did really well in American advertising centres. It did really well in sort of LA, in New York, in Chicago, where there's a concentration of advertising agencies. It did especially well in those cities. So it seemed to get a buzz around the advertising business, because I guess I don't want to talk it up too much because it's not my place, but it did seem to get something right about the ridiculous dysfunction of advertising and what a ridiculous business it can be sometimes. It seemed to get that right, I think, if it got anything right.
But I think it also crossed over outside the industry as well, because those of us who could recognise things more clearly because they were advertising, that's fine. But it was obviously really enjoyable for people who weren't in advertising as well, because, you know, it was a very successful novel. Were there any things that happened in those terms that you remember particularly?
I remember one thing in particular. I mean, I think this is the best thing that happened to me in terms of, you know, that as a result of writing a novel, lots of nice things have happened. It's opened up lots of doors for me, given me lots of nice opportunities, introduced me to lots of interesting people. But the best thing that happened was E went to space. It was the weirdest thing, that I got an invitation probably in about 2001, maybe a couple of years after the book had been published, from the US Embassy in London, inviting me to a reception with a space shuttle crew, a NASA space shuttle crew, who were coming to London to do a presentation. They were on this sort of global publicity tour to draw attention to the great work that NASA was doing. And I thought, wow, I'm going to meet some astronauts. But why? I had no idea why I was being asked to this reception to meet these astronauts. And Maria and I went to this thing at the US Embassy and met this crew, and there was Roger Daltrey there, and I'll explain why Roger Daltrey from The Who was there in a minute. But it turned out that one of the astronauts was a massive fan of E's, a guy called Piers Sellers, who sadly died at the end of last year. But he's a British-born astronaut who took American citizenship in order to join the NASA program. He had to be an American, so he took American citizenship and applied to join the NASA program, and subsequently went to space 3 times. This was his first trip to space. He'd been given his book, the book by his brother when he flew out to Houston to join his crewmates to start training for this mission they were going to go on. He loved the book. He passed it around the crewmates. It got passed around the NASA Space Center in Houston, and it became this sort of cult read within NASA and Houston. They all seemed to recognize, you know, that the dysfunction of advertising office life was actually very similar to the dysfunction of Space Center office life. You know, basically, offices can be really dysfunctional, fucked up places, and it doesn't matter what business you're in. If you read E and you worked in an office, you'll probably recognize something about your workplace in that book. But anyway, it caught on in NASA, and Piers took it up to space and had a photograph of there was my mugshot from the book. He had a photograph of himself taken holding my mugshot by a window in the shuttle with Planet Earth behind him, and then took this little photograph up into the International Space Station, got a special passport stamp on it to authenticate that it had been to the International Space Station, brought it back to Earth in order to give it to me. And it's like, what this is what astronauts do, apparently, is they take things to space in order to say, these things have been to space. And they either take something precious to them, like their wife's wedding ring or a family heirloom or something. It has to be a small thing. You haven't got enough room. So they haven't got much room for personal belongings up in space. So they take little things. One guy, the Russian astronaut, was a fan of The Who, so he'd taken The Who's next CD up to space, got it stamped in the space station, brought it back in order to meet one of The Who when he went on a publicity tour. He wanted to meet one of his heroes, so he wanted to meet either Roger Daltrey or Pete Townsend, and he got Roger Daltrey to come to this reception. That's why he was there. So he could be handed this CD of Who's next with a stamp from the space station on it, and I was handed, you know, a copy of a photograph of me with a space station stamp on it, International Space Station stamp on it. So it was like, I was just gobsmacked by this, because I thought, I'm meeting a fucking astronaut. This is like the biggest heroes in the world. These, you know, few people who go to space, I'm meeting one, and he's a fan of mine. I couldn't believe it was the best thing that ever happened. I couldn't believe it. It was just a wonderful thing, and I'll never get over it. I still get excited thinking about it now that somebody loved this book so much they took it to space. So I've kind of been to space, and that was the best thing that happened, was writing that book. Sorry, I've been very long-winded about telling that story, but it's the only really good story I've got, actually.
Well, having written off myself and made not very much money off it, maybe I'm assuming you still kept your job in advertising at this time, and if so, were you thinking of transitioning into full-time novelising?
No, you know what I did? I was very lucky with my first book. I got quite a decent advance for it, because there were like 6 or 7 British publishers buying for it, and so that pushed the advance price up, and I got quite a decent chunk of money for it, and I thought, ooh, right, I'm a novelist now, and I stopped advertising. You know, I'd been made redundant by McCann Erickson, which is another thing I can thank for, because getting fired by them meant that I gave myself 3 months to finish the book. Well, I wasn't finishing it while I was doing a full-time job. I just didn't have enough time. But because they gave me a payoff, I thought I can sit at home, not worry about the mortgage for 3 months and finish this book, and I did. So they enabled me, you know, paying me off, and they possibly would never have got finished if I carried on working. And once I finished it, it sold relatively quickly. And so I thought, oh, I'll be a novelist now. And I thought of it as a career change. So I did actually stop working for about 9 years and wrote another 6 novels, I think, 7 novels. No, another 6. I've written 7 in all. And then in about 2008, I was offered a job by M&C Saatchi in London. And it was just as the financial crisis was happening, I thought, ooh, the world's going into meltdown here, and I'm being offered quite a decent job. I better take it. So I took it. So, yeah, I had quite a long time out of advertising where I really didn't. I did very occasional bits of freelance, but we're talking about maybe, you know, 3-4 weeks a year of freelance. And most of the time I was pomping around being a novelist.
And I guess those years, those early 2000 years, there was a lot of change that happened in the industry. I mean, digital really happened in that time. So were you keeping tabs on all that sort of stuff and making sure like that was part of...
not really. I was kind of, just because, you know, I being a novelist, you know, you're aware of the onslaught, you know, digital is coming, because it's affecting the way books are published, and it's affecting the way books are marketed, and the way that books are consumed, because suddenly people are trying to do e-books and think, you know, how can they sell books without printing them on paper and all of that kind of thing. So I was aware of it, but coming back into the business full-time in 2008 was just about at the very beginning, I'd say, of, even though digital had been around, I mean, I suppose in a sense, writing a book all written in emails was the beginning of digital. I was catching the beginning of that wave when email was still a new and exciting thing, and email seemed old-fashioned now. You know, it seems really a really old-school thing now, email, because there's so many fresh, you know, Snapchatty, WhatsAppy kind of ways of talking to each other. So that, you know, that's definitely the first wave of digital. I suppose coming back into the business full time in 2008 was, I'd say, the beginning of this kind of second wave of digital, when suddenly everything, you know, stopped. You know, when I came back into this the business, we were still thinking in terms largely of, oh, we do TV commercials, and we do the posters, and we do the print ads, and maybe we do a little bit of digital display, not too much of that. It's not a big deal. It's, you know, digital display is just like, how do we make the print ad or the poster work as a banner or whatever? But now it's really changed, you know, and I've seen that over the last 8 years of working, how completely it's transformed the way we think and what we do and how we work. So I don't think it has really caught on, I don't think, in those first 8 years. I don't think it had a really revolutionary effect in those sort of much of the first decade of the 21st century, but it's the second decade where it's really had a transformative effect on the business, as well as pretty much everything else in life. You know, you look at the way all print media has been fucked up by the internet.
Yeah,
you know, everything has changed. The way we consume film, television, and everything has completely changed.
So, you wrote the sequel to E Squared, and then I guess you wrote novels that weren't in that format. So, did you feel a sort of confidence enough to sort of break out of what was your original idea, because you had had success as a novelist in terms of creating characters and things?
Yeah, you know what? I said a few moments ago that the second novel was really, really hard to write. It was, because I think suddenly I felt pressure. There was pressure on me. I had like a 2-book deal with HarperCollins, so they paid me to write a second book. And suddenly I was under pressure. It wasn't just writing for fun. It was writing to someone else. And, you know, there were certain expectations, I think, of the book. And I really struggled with it. And in fact, I wrote it, submitted it, it got rejected, then I started again. You know, so I wrote book two twice. It was kind of the same story, the same spine to it, some of the same characters, but the second version was completely different to the first. I really screwed up the first version. So, you know, I felt like book two, the first version was very self-conscious, I think. Suddenly I was conscious of being a novelist, and it wasn't just this sort of joyful, throw myself into the deep end, don't care about anything, don't worry about anything, just write the fucking thing. The first one, the second one was tedious, the first version of it. But yeah, after that it became a little easier. I thought, you know, I think once that got accepted and published, I thought, I'm beginning to understand how to do this. So, and I'm beginning to realise that I could actually write in more conventional prose, because most of the books I've written have been, you know, what you call more conventional. You know, I've only written, there was a sequel to E that was actually the last book I wrote a few years ago, and a very short Christmas sequel to it, but the rest of the books I've written have been what you call conventional novels, certainly in their format.
And when you moved into the sort of into the conventional novel area, was there pressure on you to be the funny guy, because you had the sort of brand of Matt Beaumont author going on? And were you
asking? Yeah, I mean, I'd say to varying degrees, you know, all of the books I've written attempt to be humorous, and I think that's kind of my thing. And I've thought, it's funny, because I've thought recently, because I've had a gap of a few years since I've written a book, I've thought, oh, I'd like to write something else, and maybe it shouldn't be funny. Maybe I should try something else. Maybe I should try something that, you know, starts with a murder and sort of goes downhill from there in terms of darkness or something. I don't know. I'm sort of talking out of my arse, really, because these aren't things, you know, these are just things I've idly thought about. But I think if I ever did sit down and write a book again, it would probably have humour in it to some extent. because it's kind of not necessarily because that's what's expected of me, but because that's what I feel comfortable doing. I think it's just kind of the way I write.
Yeah.
You know, in creative writing classes, they talk about finding your voice, and I think I found my voice fairly quickly, and it sort of had cynical jokes in it, my voice. So that's the way it went.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting because there's lots of people. I've spoken to Paul Burke for a couple of episodes, and I did one particularly just on book writing, because not writing novels or being creative on your own is very, very different in terms of your sort of day-to-day lifestyle than working in an ad agency. Did you find you preferred one to the other, or there were pros and cons to both?
There's clearly pros and cons to both. I think, if I'm honest, I prefer writing novels because, I mean, yeah, ultimately you're writing for an audience. You know, initially you're writing for your agent and your publisher, and then you're writing for hopefully the people that will review the book and then buy the book. So, but really you're doing it for yourself, whereas when you're in advertising, you're working to a brief, you're not doing it for yourself. You're compromising your voice for whatever the brief demands of you, whatever the client demands, the kind of idea you think they want and so on. And then there's all these clearly layers and layers of approval, you know, internal approval initially, and then client approval and so on, and possibly focus groups. You know, no novel I've written has ever gone to a focus group before it got published. So I prefer novel writing because I quite like working on my own, and I quite like working at least in the sort of 3-5 month bubble while I'm writing it. I like working where I've got the sense of I'm only pleasing myself. I'm just writing something that makes me happy, that I can look back on at the end of the day and think, that's good or not good, and change it or whatever. But that's what I really enjoy about writing books, this sense of, at least while you're doing it, you're just doing it for yourself rather than for someone else, which is necessarily what you're doing in advertising, is you're always doing it for someone else. You know, you're always compromising your creativity to a brief. And that's the nature of the job. That's the definition of the job. So, you know, there's a lot to be enjoyed in advertising, and, you know, not least the social side of being in an office and working with people and having input and inspiration from other people, just the company of other people, which you don't get when you're writing a novel. But I do like writing a novel. If I had to choose one, I'd choose that.
I mean, it's almost a sort of cliche that I think we're all aware of advertising writers having a sort of half-finished novel or screenplay or whatever somewhere in their drawer or trying to do it. And you're one of the people who's actually done it, but to a very high level of success. Have you had a lot of people within the industry asking you about how that happened or why or what they're doing
wrong?
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of people did. I've had people wanting to show me things I've written of this. I can make a difference, you know, and usually, you know, if people are showing you something like a novel or a screenplay that they've written, it's huge, and it takes a lot of time to read it and digest it and figure out what you think of it and then formulate some kind of feedback that you hope will be honest but constructive and so on. So I've tried to avoid it if I possibly can without being rude, but yeah, I mean, you do get asked a certain amount of, how do you do that, and how do you get an agent, and how do you get published, and, you know, it's kind of, you know, there's no magic to it, you just kind of have to do it, you just have to, well, write it, and then send it to people, and if it's good, someone will publish it. It really is as simple as that. You know, there are agents out there who will read material from, you know, unsolicited material from unpublished authors, and they'll read at least 30 pages of it, and they seem to think that they can make a pretty fair judgment over 30 pages or so, or maybe 50 pages, whether it's any good or not, you know, whether it's got merit or potential or it's excellent, you know, and if they do think it's good, they'll read on to the end and, you know, then possibly share it with publishers. So, you know, I think that's, you know, it's still the same, that, you know, if you want to write a novel, certainly, just write it and get it out there, and if it's any good, hopefully someone will realise that and publish it.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's how it worked for me. I didn't have any, there was no magic, I didn't know anyone in the publishing business, I didn't have any contacts, literary agents or publishing houses who could, you know, open a door for me. I just wrote something and sent it to about 8 agents, and one saw something in it. I mean, I think I sent it out when I'd written 50 pages or so.
Right.
I thought, oh, I've got something here. I thought, you know, I genuinely thought I'd got something that I thought I could finish and that I thought was quite good. And 7 agents didn't agree with me and rejected it. But one agent read it and she said, I really like this. I very much doubt you can finish it. She thought it was an unsustainable idea. She thought that reading 300 or so pages of email after email would just get grating in the end. And, you know, the story wouldn't be able to develop in a normal way or whatever she thought. But she didn't believe it would work. But she encouraged me to finish it, see if it would work. And luckily for me, I did finish. You know, that gave me the incentive to finish it. And then I sent it to her, and she still liked it, luckily. And she found it.
If I can just get slightly technical about writing here for just one question. I think I remember when I spoke to you years ago, I think when I was doing my own novel, we discussed the difference between writing, you know, 5,000 shit words in a day or 500 good ones, as opposed to, you know, as two different styles where you go, okay, those are 500 words that I'm very happy with at the end of my day, rather than I've written 5,000 words and they're a bit of a mess and I'll go back and change them. And I think you're more of the 500 good words. Was that the case? And is that...
Yeah, I mean, I remember I always used to sort of in a kind of anal way to keep a sort of running total of my word count of how many, you know, when I was writing every day or nearly every day, I'd keep a tally of, oh, I've done 500 words today or 1,500 today. And I think on a really productive day, the most I ever did was about 2,000 words. But more, it would be more like 500 to 1,000 words in a day I'd do. And I'm the kind of writer who writes it and then edits it and edits again. I edit as I go. So at the end of the day, I've got something that actually is fairly polished. You know, but I don't think, I think it's whatever suits you as a writer. Maria, my partner, she's written novels as well, and her approach is completely different. She's much more prolific than I am in terms of word count, and she's the sort of person who will write 5,000 words a day, and she'd say herself that, well, it's pretty messy, and, you know, it's horribly repetitive and not structured very well, and I haven't chosen the best words, you know, to whatever, and so on. But she's someone who'll just get the whole thing down in a splurge and then go back to the beginning and start editing. And her, you know, her first draft will require a lot of editing, but she does it fairly quickly, whereas my first draft will take much less editing, but it takes me a much longer to do. You know, and that suits me better. It just suits my temperament better. And her way of working suits her temperament better. So there isn't a right way or a wrong way. You know, it's you find your way as a writer. And it probably goes for writing anything, you know, whether it's screenplays, whatever.
And so when you went back into Embassy Saatchi, you and Phil have a kind of a sort of niche in there. I don't know if you wanted to describe what that is, because I don't know if you're allowed or anything like that, but it was a slightly unusual situation you had within a sort of an agency within the agency.
It's become this thing called Embassy Saatchi Export, which it's like Embassy Saatchi London is a big company with a big advertising agency and lots of other companies that it owns that all operate under the same roof. One of those little companies that it owns is Embassy Saatchi Export, which is just a kind of autonomous advertising agency. We have our own clients, our own account management resource, our own creative resource. Phil and I have been creative directors of it for the last few years. And as long as we've made money, we've been sort of left to get on with it. We've had, you know, a funny mix of clients. A lot of overseas clients who want, they like the idea of having a London advertising agency for whatever reason. They've got this idea that there's, you know, a certain quality in London that they possibly don't get in their home market. Possibly think they can't afford a London advertising agency, but because we're smaller and more tightly run, we can, you know, we can charge fees that they maybe think, you know, that MNC Saatchi, the main agency, wouldn't be able to operate economically sort of charging the level of fees that we've charged. So it's like getting London agency service, but for, you know, a slightly lower price or lower than they'd imagined to get. Some of our business has come that way. So we've had some really interesting things over the years that we've worked on. You know, we could, and not obviously advertising brief. We won the pitch. We pitched against a load of really big branding agencies, you know, the likes of Wolf Olins and so on, to rebrand Dubai, the Emirates state in the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, as we're supposed to call it now, which is basically, you know, coming up with a logo, if you like, to put the brief at its simplest. You know, and we won that pitch against... We shouldn't have won that pitch on paper because we were pitching against agencies that did that kind of work, you know, like as I say, Wolf Olins, who do that kind of work, you know, all the time. They do it really well and really successfully. We've never done that kind of work, but somehow we got on the pitch list and we won it. You know, the city logo that you see in Dubai now when you go there, which sort of represents Dubai, you'll see it on police cars, on taxis, you see it pretty much everywhere in Dubai, is something that we did. So it hasn't just been traditional advertising that we've done all kinds of interesting briefs for all kinds of interesting clients.
It's interesting when you look at your career as a writer, then a creative director in Hong Kong, then a senior writer, then a novelist, and then you're back sort of doing a job where there's sort of graphic design and things like that involved that weren't expected. Do you think there's a sort of flexibility that you have that allows you to just take things on
I guess so. I have a BA in graphic design. I could, if I really wanted to, at a stretch, call myself a graphic designer, but I've never practiced it since I graduated. Even so, I've had to kind of adapt to it. And, you know, I can't say that I came up with the idea for the Dubai logo. I was a creative director on it, and I, you know, helped sell it into the client and, you know, did a creative director's job on it. But, there was a certain amount of adaptation I've had to do. But also, just because the advertising world has changed so much in the last decade, you know, with the digital revolution, everyone's had to adapt. Everyone who hasn't come into this business with that wave, you know, basically everyone over 30 has had to adapt somehow from the traditions of print and telly and radio to what the fuck do we do on Facebook and websites and online and Snapchat and all of it. We've all had to adapt, and they're still having to adapt, and we'll carry on having to adapt because things will come along that we haven't thought of yet that will initially fuck us up until we figure out how to accommodate them. So, you know, I don't think I'm massively different in that sense to what anyone else happens to do. I'm just trying my best to cope with what's put in front of me, whether that's coming up with a new logo for Dubai or whatever else it might be in terms of the brief we're getting these days.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's been, I mean, over my career, I've been asked to do all sorts of unusual things. And I think maybe in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was a bit like, oh, this is an interesting experience. Let's maybe dip a toe in the water and then leave it for several years and never do it again. Whereas I think what's going on now is you're almost expecting to be given quite a large eclectic mix of things to do. And it's just, oh, yeah, okay, so something completely different here and something completely different there. So maybe that's what's changed in the last sort of 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the need for... I mean, one thing remains, I think, and this is true... I've thought of this in terms of novel writing, and I've thought of it in terms of advertising, is that the basic need for ideas, whether those are ideas expressed through a story as written in a novel or a TV drama or whatever, or ideas that underpin a brand and express a brand, that remains the same. That absolutely remains the same. It's, you know, it's been the same for thousands of years. The human needs are stories. You know, stories in terms of brands, stories in terms of things that entertain us, in terms of the books we read and so on. That remains. It doesn't, you know, the way we digest those stories will change. And, you that have changed over time, and you know, now books, novels are being threatened by all sorts of other media, and people are reading books online, they're reading books on Kindles and so on. They're not reading in quite the same way. They're reading things in much shorter episodes. They're stopping reading novels, but they still want to enjoy stories. However they enjoy those stories changes, but they still want to enjoy stories. It's sort of fundamental to what we are as human beings, I think. And that, you know, that can be applied to, you know, the stories that brands tell, if you like. That doesn't sound too pretentious, you know, and we express those stories in ideas, advertising ideas. But however the media landscape changes, I think that remains the same. And we might struggle to adapt to new media, but when we get down to it, we still need an idea. You know, whether the idea is, you know, a picture and three words on the poster, or it's something you do on LinkedIn, or, you know, some app you design to answer a brief or whatever, you still need the idea that underpins and essential to everything. And I think, you know, that will always be the same as long as we're, you know, humans are around, trying to talk to each other and sell stuff to each other and entertain each other, that will remain the same.
Yeah, I agree. And out of interest, do you have novel ideas bubbling up that you want to explore, or is that something that you're sort of, it's on the back burner and you're waiting for something really inspirational to hit you?
There's a couple of things I'm thinking about in terms of novels that I haven't actually started on, but there's one idea that I've been thinking about for actually 3 years, which is actually an awful long time for me to think about something. And I keep getting a little bit more of it in my head as I think about it. But I haven't actually started writing it, and I'm not sure I ever will. But it feels like a really good idea to me. So I might start writing that. There's also a couple of projects that Maria and I are working on, not novels, but TV film ideas. Sorry, I'm just being asked to take my feet off the seat by a lady who asked me very politely to take my feet off the seat.
Where are you?
I'm in the foyer of my office building, and I'm sitting on the arm of the sofa, and I have my feet on the sofa.
That's terrible. Terrible behaviour.
I know, it was terrible, and I'm just sort of brushing the dust off now, making sure I haven't left any horrible footprints. But yeah, she came over and asked me very politely to take my feet off the seat, so I've done that now. And she's gone away.
Right.
Anyway, what was I saying? So we're working on a couple of script ideas. You know, one that feels it'd be a feature film, one that feels it's definitely a sort of episodic TV drama. But that's really funny, and so that's the thing outside of advertising that's sort of inspiring me at the moment, these projects that Maria and I have got on the go. You know, very early days, it's not as if we've got production companies or backers wanting to throw money at us to make these things, but we're just starting to write them and the beginning the process of exposing them to people and trying to find someone who'll develop it. But it's quite exciting because we've never done anything like that before.
Sure, and if further advertising opportunities come up, they're going to be worth exploring as well, I guess.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. I mean, I still really enjoy the advertising business, so, you know, Phil and I are moving on from MNC Saatchi fairly shortly, so we're looking for opportunities elsewhere, you know, whether that's direct to clients or, you know, in other advertising agencies or things that maybe don't call themselves advertising agencies anymore because that's so old-fashioned, so 1980s. But, so we're looking at the moment, seeing what's out there.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat to me, and sorry that your feet obviously had offended the poor lady in your reception, but
she was so nice about it. I mean, I think if I said no, fuck off, I'm leaving my feet here, she'd have probably gone away. I don't think she'd have
insisted. Cool. Okay. Well, I'll let you get back to whatever you were doing before, and huge thanks for your time again. Thanks, Matt.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's really nice to talk to you. And see you when you come over here, or if I ever make it over there. Okay?
Sure. Say hi to Phil. Thanks.
I will do. See you later.
Okay. Cheers, mate. Bye.
that's the worst Christmas.